WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Over the decades, we became so used to Allen Ginsberg's presence at the forefront of cultural change that it's hard to accept he's gone. He died over the weekend at the age of 70, shortly after being diagnosed with liver cancer. In the 50s, he was one of the most important beat poets. In the 60s, he inspired a younger generation of hippies and spoke out against the war in Vietnam. Through the 70s and 80s, he continued to write and to explore Eastern religions. By the 90s, he was an inspiration to up-and-coming performance poets. I spoke with him in 1994, after the release of a CD box set called Holy Soul Jelly Roll, which collects Ginsberg's poems and songs as recorded between 1949 and 1993. It includes his first complete reading of his now classic poem, Howl. This historic recording was made by a photographer in the audience at Berkeley's Town Hall Theater in 1956.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn, looking for an angry fix. Angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo in the machinery of night, who poverty and tatters and hollow-eyed and high sat up smoking in the supernatural darkness of cold water flats floating across the tops of cities contemplating jazz.
Howl was partly inspired by Allen Ginsberg's mother, who had been in a mental hospital.
She had been there for several years, and I had put her there after a breakthrough of sort of very violent behavior toward her sister and a cousin she was staying with. And then I had gone out to San Francisco, but the grief was very much on my mind. I had a friend, Carl Solomon, with whom I had been in a mental hospital 6 years before, and he was back also in Pilgrim State, too. So I addressed the poem ostensibly to him, but the emotions were, I think, directed toward my mother, both grief and a sense of solidarity.
Yeah, you know, part one begins with one of your most famous lines.
Yeah.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness.
Starving, hysterical, naked. The original phrase was starving, mystical, naked, but I figured that was a little bit too simple-minded. Because the problem was not all the problem of society, it was also the neurosis of the people. So there's a certain ironic edge to it, which I don't think critics at the time realized. I said starving, hysterical, naked. So it wasn't just a one-dimensional protest for the safety of madmen. It was also like trying to give a quick sketches of a series of cases that I drew from real life.
Now I want to move on to another poem, America.
Yeah.
It was read the same night as Howl.
Yes, and that's the very reading. First unveiling of that poem. It's really funny. The text in the recording differs a little from the final text that I wound up with.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few extra, some very funny lines, actually.
Yeah, it really is very funny, and you get a lot of laughs from the audience.
Well, it sounds like a stand-up comedy routine. That's the era, actually, of Lenny Bruce around San Francisco. He was playing, I think, at the Purple Onion, and I went down to see him and watch his act, actually. But I hadn't expected that kind of reaction. And I didn't think the poem was that good, nor did Kerouac. It was just sort of like a joke, you know, like a takeoff, send-up of America, very lighthearted. But it's done with many different voices in a kind of schizophrenic persona. You know, 1 minute serious, 1 minute faggoty, 1 minute desperate, 1 minute religious, 1 minute patriotic, 1 minute I'm putting my queer shoulders to the wheel.
Why don't we hear the beginning of America as you read it in 1956 at Town Hall in Berkeley.
America, I've given you all, and now I'm nothing. America, $2.27, January 17th, 1956. America, I can't stand my own mind. America, when will we end the human war? Go f*** yourself with your atom bomb. I don't feel good. Don't bother me. I won't write my poem until I'm in my right mind. When will you be angelic? When will you take off your clothes? When will you look at yourself through the grave? When will you be worthy of your million Christs? America, why are your libraries full of tears? America, when will you send your eggs to India? I'm sick of your insane demands. When will you reinvent the heart? When will you manufacture lambs? When will your cowboys read Spengler? When will your dams release the flood of eastern tears? When will your technicians get drunk and abolish money? When will you institute religions of perception in your legislatures? When can I go into the supermarket and buy what I need with my good looks? America, after all, it is you and I who are perfect, not the next world. Your machinery is too much for me. I don't want to work for a living. You made me want to be a saint. There must be some other way to settle this argument.
You know, you must have seen yourself as a provocateur in a way at a very young age. I'm thinking, you know, that you were just coming from a place that was not average. You know, your mother was mentally ill. Your mother had been a communist. You were gay. You were an intellectual. You loved poetry. I mean, about your life kind of set you apart.
But you got to realize, by this time, I had already known William Burroughs and Jack Kerouac 12 years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This is not, you know, some sudden discovery of a community or ideas. We had had a long period of privacy and silence to ripen our art, to know each other and to amuse each other and to understand each other's language and intelligence and sort of enlarge our own consciousness with the experience of others. I'd already had some sort of natural religious experience, and we had all by this time tried out some of the psychedelic drugs in addition, on top of a natural religious experience that was without drugs. And already had traveled a bit, and so we were, I wasn't a young kid then, I was 28 years old. You know, it was quite a ripe time.
Was it surprising to you to find people like Burroughs and Kerouac, who you felt this kind of friendship and aesthetic closeness with?
No, it was just some sort of natural kinship that we felt almost instantly on meeting.
But did you expect you'd ever find that?
Not exactly, but I hadn't even conceived of such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I conceived of friends, and I'd had friends in high school, but I was still in the closet. Kerouac was the first person I was able to come out of the closet to and tell him about it, and actually slept with him once or twice, though he was primarily straight. But he was very tender toward me, and he saw that I was in solitary and in a great deal of confusion and anguish, and he took a sort of kindly view. Burroughs was always out front and clear and lucid and intelligent, as he is now. At the age of 80, he was so. At the age of 34, I think he was then. So I was lucky when I was 17 that I met people whose genius sort of ignited my own talents and upgraded, I think, my own natural intelligence. But I'm really a student of Kerouac and of Burroughs, and in some respects an imitator. I've had a steadier life, and so I'm perhaps more on the scene as now, on the air, or going around giving readings. But I feel myself basically a pupil of Kerouac's ear and his intelligence and language and his awareness of the pronunciation of consonants.
Well, when you talk about being a student of Kerouac's, I've never been able to tell how much your style of reading influenced him and how much his style of reading influenced you.
Oh, I think his style influenced me. It was way back in 47, 48, I heard him read Shakespeare aloud. And it was such an interesting intonation that he put into a soliloquy of Hamlet, I think, where Hamlet is sitting down on the steps saying, "What am I? What am I doing? Am I nothing but a John of Dreams?" And the way Kerouac said, "A John of Dreams," it was like his mind went off into a little dream about it in that phrase. So I began seeing that there were intonations, differences of pitch, possible You know, most poetry still is pronounced in a monotone or a duotone. It's like I'm talking now in a sort of monotone. But there are possibilities in conversation where you go from, you know, a little high woodle when you're talking to a little baby to down to very serious heart tones when you're talking to your grandmother and on her last days on earth.
Of course, with your readings, I always felt that there was a certain Hebraic intonation, even though I know that, you know, Buddhism was probably an even greater influence on you, and you certainly hear that in your voice too, but there is that kind of Hebraic.
The Hebraic
sound
thing is very real. Mm-hmm. My grandfathers were rabbis, and one of the most strong musical influence I ever had was the hearing of a recording of Sophie Breslau, a great operatic singer, singing Eli Eli, with a kind of melismus, I guess you'd call it, sort of a very beautiful way of bending the notes that's characteristic of Hebrew melody.
Now, when did that start to enter your reading style?
Well, certainly with Kaddish, because I was imitating the davening motion of Kaddish with the sound of Yishgadal, Yishgadas, Yishaleh, Yishalov, Med, Kushu, Bukhu, da-da-da, 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 magnificent, mourn no more, martyr of heart, mind behind, married dream, mortal changed. Hmm. That is the whole rhythm of the poem has a kind of combination of Ray Charles, I Got a Woman, Yes Indeed, Yes Indeed, Yes Indeed, and which I'd been hearing the morning before I wrote the poem, and a rhythm of the original Hebrew Kaddish that was still running through my mind and body. For the first time I'd heard it, actually, a Jewish friend played it to me in dawn light the morning that I started writing the poem.
And the Kaddish is the Hebrew prayer for the dead.
Yes, it's a kind of a mass or a prayer for the dead done in the synagogue when you have a minyan or a group of elders that can get together to help you mourn for the dead.
So I guess you didn't say the prayer when your mother died.
Well, I didn't know it as well, but I did try and do it. Actually, I wandered around San Francisco with Jack Kerouac and Philip Whalen, and we went into various synagogues, but there was no minyan, so that we couldn't do it. So this is a way of making up about a couple years later.
And this is a couple of years after your mother, Naomi,
yeah, my mother died.
Died
in 55. Incidentally, you know, I sent her a copy of the original manuscript of Howl, which she received about a week before she died, and she wrote me a letter which was postmarked the day she died, which is quoted in Kaddish, in which she said she got my poems. She can't tell whether it's good or bad. My father should judge because he's a poet, but judging from the... she'd read it, obviously. She said, "But get married, Alan, don't take drugs." And she said, "I have the key. The key is in the window. The key is in the sunlight in the window." And then she died of stroke, I think, perhaps hours or within 24 hours of writing the letter. So I received that letter after I had heard that she died.
Huh.
So it was like a message from the land of the dead, so to speak.
We're featuring a 1994 interview with Allen Ginsberg. He died over the weekend at the age of 70. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1994 interview with Allen Ginsberg. Now, if you had grandfathers who were rabbis, did you say?
Well, scholars, you know, long guys with big black hats and long bearded, long gray beards, who died of cancer from smoking, actually,
in New York
in the 30s.
How did you get to be in your 20s before you heard the prayer for the dead?
Well, we didn't. My mother was communist and my father was socialist.
So you didn't go to a synagogue?
So I did go to synagogue, and I went to Sunday school, or what do you call it, to learn Hebrew and traditional, prepare for a bar mitzvah, but somehow I asked questions that were resented by the rabbi, and I got kicked out when I was about 8 years old or nine. And I never did understand it, because I thought I was just sort of talking intelligently to him and inquiring, that there must have been an edge of skepticism to it. But mm-hmm. there was no tolerance for that at all. Mm. My questions weren't answered, and I was just told to get out. So I've never had very much of a classical Hebrew education.
Your mother was institutionalized several times.
Many, many times. All during my childhood, I had to go out to visit her in Greystone Hospital.
Were you frightened by her madness?
Sometimes sorrowed, sometimes frightened, sometimes stuck with a responsibility I couldn't carry out as a kid. going out alone to see her in a mental hospital when I was 12, 13, 14. Or having to stay home and take care of her while my father was in school teaching, and getting into crisis situations with her that I couldn't handle, actually. It kind of broke my brain in a way, broke my spirit to some extent.
Now, when you started doing hallucinogenics, like LSD, did your hallucinations ever scare you because you'd seen your mother have hallucinations and delusions because of her mental illness?
Well, no, not really. I realized that if everybody began disagreeing with me, I better look around twice and think three times and be pretty sure I knew what I was doing. And so I've been able to be in situations where everybody disagreed, but at the same time maintain my sanity, so to speak, by simply following my heart, really. I have as much a tendency to paranoia as anybody in the United States at this point, but at least I can see it's paranoia, and most people don't see their own paranoia.
That's interesting. So your mother's delusions actually helped you figure out what was real and what wasn't?
Well, I went through I sort of went through the mill already, so I was kind of inoculated. I would say that the experience of having to deal with somebody who was sort of deluded and hallucinating, also voices and all, helped me deal with my own psychic disturbances and also with the psychic disturbances of other people. I seem to have a kind of tolerance that, you know, in one ear, out the other, or, you know, like so that I can be with people who are quite disturbed, get disturbed myself, but not so much so that I have to turn my back until, you know, all hope is lost.
Where were you in your performance style in 1964, the year that the recording of Kaddish was made?
I hadn't ever tried to read anything as long as Kaddish, complete. And so there, and I had drunk a little bit, not very much, so I wasn't really drunk, but I was sort of a little keyed up with alcohol so that I was able to loosen my feelings quite a bit. So the only problem there is maintaining control of feelings and not breaking up and crying in the middle of the more moving passages.
Is there a particular section of Kaddish that you've had the most problem with controlling your emotion?
Yeah, there's a section that begins when I'm visiting my mother in the mental hospital for the last time, and I walk in and I see she's had a stroke, and then there suddenly is a break in the poem, and there's a kind of lyrical rhapsody. Communist beauty, sit here married in the summer among daisies promised. Happiness at hand. To a section that ends, oh, beautiful garbo of my karma. It's really a nice, exquisite, poetic passage, but it's also full of feeling, and it's like a flashback in the midst of tragedy to a happier day. And so there's a lot of emotion buried there from childhood. Also, at the very end, the section, oh, mother, what have I left out? Oh, mother, what have I forgotten? With your eyes, with your death full of flowers. That has a sort of cumulative emotional buildup that's quite great.
Why don't I play an excerpt of Kaddish? And you wrote this in the late 1950s. The recording we're going to hear from your new box set was made at Brandeis University in 1964.
With your eyes running naked out of the apartment, screaming into the hall, with your eyes being led away by policemen to an ambulance, with your eyes strapped down on an operating table, with your eyes with a pancreas removed, with your eyes of appendix operation, with your eyes of abortion, with your eyes of ovaries removed, with your eyes of shock, with your eyes of lobotomy, with your eyes of divorce, with your eyes of stroke, with your eyes alone, with your eyes, with your eyes, with your death full of flowers.
That's Allen Ginsberg reading an excerpt of Kaddish. It's included on his new box set, Holy Soul, Jelly Roll. Tell us just a little bit about what your life is like now.
Well, I have a little heart trouble and diabetes, but I travel a bit still, and I write quite a bit, and I'm doing a lot of photography and put out several books of photos. And so this year I think I'll do some doodles and have them sort of start drawing. So, you know, just enjoying myself at the age of 68, extending my activities in various directions, but focused primarily on writing and on poetry, with the idea that candor ends paranoia. If I can make my own mind transparent so that people know what I'm really thinking, they don't have anything to be scared of, and they can use it as a mirror for their own minds.
Allen Ginsberg, recorded in 1994. He died Saturday at the age of 70, shortly after being diagnosed with liver cancer. This is Fresh Air.